This is Colourful Radio.
Joining me now is Kate Hoey, of course, the MP for Vauxhall, in which the mighty Colourful Empire is situated. And she's managed to find her way through this gigantic building and up to the 945th floor on which we're based. And Kate, good morning.
Good morning.
It's very, very nice to have you with us. Kate, I've been billing you in the in my sort my preamble. Let people know who's coming on the show. And I've been billing you as the most independent MP in the House of Commons. Do you think that's fair?
Well, when I got elected, I promised my constituents that I would speak out for them no matter who was running Lambeth Council, which was my local area, and who was running government. And that doesn't mean to say that you deliberately are disloyal to your own party, but you try wherever possible, I think, to do what's right. And sometimes what I think's right and what my constituents think right is not necessarily what the party might be saying. So I think you have to get that balance. And yes, I am quite independent.
Because, of course, you were a government minister for a while, weren't you?
Yes, I was in the Home Office for a year, which was most interesting, looking at policing in London, which was a particularly interesting thing to do. And then I moved into being sports minister, and I enjoyed that enormously. I mean, that was a great thing, but I think at the end of it, whilst I achieved a bit in terms of getting people to think about school sport again and getting that whole area opened up, it's quite difficult when you sometimes think that you know the right thing that you want to do and it doesn't quite fit into what the overall government priorities are.
Did you find it difficult being part of, you know, having to take sort of collective responsibility, it were, and being part of a team when obviously compromises were necessary?
Yes, I think there's always that conflict. And I think what most people do, and certainly I did, was I just, particularly when I was doing the work on sport, which was really, really important to me, and getting young people with opportunities and all of the things that I wanted to do, you just almost were in a kind of, umbrella, so that you almost tried not to know what was going on, because I think if I'd, you know, some of the things that you would have to go in and vote for that you didn't particularly want to. So there's no doubt about it. I mean, it's great having been a minister, because when you've been a minister and you've been inside government and understood how it works, it makes you a much better backbencher when you come out of being a minister, because you know how it works and you know where the buttons are to press and you know who to not to upset or who to upset.
You, of course, famously are a huge supporter of fox hunting. And I believe, I don't know if you still are, you were certainly the chairman of the Countryside Alliance. Are you still?
Yes, I'm chairman of the Countryside Alliance.
And it's based, interestingly, in Vauxhall.
It's in Kennington, yes, the headquarters. No, I chair the board every now and again, and I'm very keen to... when you say I'm a great supporter of fox hunting, I think you want to put it almost the other way around. I am totally against banning something that was not doing anything about animal welfare. I mean, the argument always was this was all about, you know, animal welfare. Actually, the reality is that foxes now, now that there's a ban, although hunting is still continuing legally within the law, foxes are being killed in much, much more dreadful ways, because foxes are not, it's not illegal to kill foxes. And what a lot of my colleagues and other people didn't like was the feeling that it was a sort of class thing, that it was only rich people and out in horses, when actually if you go out into countryside and visit any of the hunts made up of all sorts of people, not necessarily on horseback, but in doing something that has always happened. And so the Countryside Alliance is more really now, it's widened, it's also about obviously hunting and get the ban repealed, which we're pretty sure will happen, but more about making people in understanding the link between countryside and urban. You know, I've got youngsters in my area who I now get out into the countryside for days to see what farms are like, what cows look like. And, you know, we have a fantastic little city farm near here. And it's amazing just how young people, when they get involved with animals, how different it makes them feel. And I just think there's a huge gap between the country. And so I don't think there's any disengagement between urban and rural. I want to see us all working together.
I've got a colleague who lives in Kent and has recently had some foxes build a hide in her back garden. And she actually found a dead fox on her patio. And when she called the council, they told her that if she harmed the foxes in any way, she'd have a £5,000 fine.
What, by that would probably be if she did anything herself. I mean, it seems ridiculous. We have in Vauxhall around here, I mean, literally any evening you go out, you would see a fox somewhere.
Yes.
And they're not very healthy foxes either sometimes. And they're, you know, they can spread diseases. And indeed, we had an incident where a fox actually attacked, well, attacked is probably the wrong word, but ate one of a baby animal, that a little rabbit that somebody had in Stockwell. This was some years ago. But yeah, if you ring up and say you've got a foxes in your garden, the local councils don't want to know. What they do in London is they tend to, if they finally have to pick one up, they'll just take it out and dump it out in the countryside, so causing, and those kind of urban foxes aren't going to be able to survive in the countryside very long.
Well, they wouldn't, but no 24-hour shops.
No.
They wouldn't know where to go. They'd be completely...
In fact, my colleague said that she'd found a burger box by the fox's hide, and she never eats burgers, so they're obviously on a great
bringing
diet.
Bringing it in, yeah.
Healthy eating for foxes. Yeah. Okay, we're going to go to this, and then we are going to come back to speak to Kate Huey some more.
This is Colourful Radio.
Yes, and we're back. It's 8:35 on Colourful Radio. Here we are this morning, and I've got with me Kate Huey, MP for Vauxhall, and also, as I've described, the most independent MP in the House of Commons. Now, we were talking about your chairmanship, seemingly rather paradoxical chairmanship of the Countryside Alliance based in Vauxhall, and I know you know we're talking about fox hunting, and you're feeling that there was no legitimate grounds for banning it, and I want to come on to it, just to push you on this slightly. I used to know, shared an office with a lady who was and the joint master of the old Surrey and Bearstead Hunt, and we used to have these conversations. And I suppose my issue was, it's not so much that I recognise that really it's not doing very much damage, you know, the animal welfare issue, as the fact that people are chasing and killing animals for pleasure. That's my issue about it. And I've always felt that it was a bit like fencing and sword fighting. There was a time when people used to kill each other with swords, and then they decided that wasn't a very good idea, and fencing replaced it. And I can't, apart from the issue about whether or not the foxes are killed, which I take, I can't help but believe that some other system would have, you know, come into play where they'd still be able to do the hunt, but they wouldn't have actually killed the fox, and thus eliminated the idea of killing animals for pleasure.
Well, of course, the main aim of a fox hunt is to actually control foxes, and they're asked to go into particular areas where farmers have had particular problems. It is a form of pest control. Once you decide that the form of pest control, I mean, the fox is not being taken out of its natural environment like bear baiting and all the other things that sometimes people try and go along with it. The fox is in its natural environment. The fox is used to being chased by other animals. It also chases other animals. It's not, the fox doesn't actually care. The fox doesn't sit down and say, I'm going to die now. Would I rather die by being shot, or would I rather die by being caught by hounds and killed instantly? Shooting is, if I have seen foxes who have been shot and shot badly, and they go off and they have a lingering, horrible, miserable death. Huge, huge pain. So there's that element. But the vast majority of people who go out with the hunt, either on foot or on horseback, never are anywhere near.
No. You know,
and they're going out, part of it, it is a kind of, yes, it is a sort of ritual in a way, but at the end of it, you have to decide whether people who like to do things, provided they're not harming anyone else, provided the animal's welfare aspects where is the problem?
Well, I suppose the problem in my mind is the idea that you're going out, the pleasure is in the killing.
No, you see, I think if you actually spoke to most people, I mean, I doubt if that woman that you talked about actually talked about the pleasure of killing. And no one even thinks about that, to be, you know, really isn't.
Look, I
don't think we should, you know, I'm
not going to push it, because I actually am very torn by it, genuinely, because the ritual part of it, the countryside, you know, the tradition of it, I think is fantastic. And a much underrated writer and slightly forgotten writer now, H.E. Bates, of course, wrote Darling Buds of May, but also wrote some fantastic novels, particularly about a rural Northamptonshire in the early part of the 20th century, much to be recommended. I remember one of them, I can't remember the name of the title now, in which fox hunting, the ritual of fox hunting, is very important. And when you read this, you realise, you know, how embedded it is, has been in the country.
That's right.
Way
and
of
I
life.
Think, I think what's nice about what you're doing, I mean, you're questioning and you're talking about it. If only many of my colleagues who voted to ban had done that and gone and visited hunts and talked to people. The problem is it was put in as a sort of, you know, if you support fox hunting or you don't want to see it banned, you must be some kind of nasty sadist. And of course, that is just complete.
Well, isn't it the case with so many issues, though, that if you take a stand, it's very, very difficult, isn't it, in the face of media hype, in the political correctness, if you like, to stand up and say, look, this is not right, you know. Yeah. To be an individual. Now, let me move on to another thing, which I know you had questioned, which was the Olympics. Now, you weren't 100% for the London Olympics, were you, originally?
No, but I wasn't 100% against it. I think the things that I wrote then were all before we got the bid. I was questioning the way we bid for it. I was questioning things like the fact that we had in this country not invested in sport over the years that other countries had. I wrote a little bit about Paris and how Paris had a swimming pool, literally everywhere you went, every community had its own swimming pool, its own tennis courts, its own, that was all part of their community, and that Paris had actually more 50-metre swimming pools than we had in the whole of the United Kingdom. And I was saying, you know, should the Olympics actually be the icing on the cake when you've got all these things going? In which case Paris should get it, or should it be something that hopefully would actually then promote everything so that you end up with not just a six-week wonder of the Olympics and the Paralympics and everybody saying, that's great, we've got some medals, and watching it on television mostly, which they could have done if it had been in Paris, but actually ends up with a real legacy that would give a difference to communities like I represent and communities all over London, the whole 33 London boroughs. Yeah. So, but people really got upset. You know, they couldn't stand the fact that you were almost saying, it's like when everybody's trying to do something, if one person says anything, then the criticism with a small c gets exaggerated because it doesn't play into what the prevailing line was.
If you want to join this discussion and have any questions or comments about the Olympics, about fox hunting, then do give Colourful Radio a text on 80818. Start your text with Colourful, followed by your message, and we'll read them out on air.
Yeah, I think if you took a vote now, should we have the Olympics? I'm sure that lots of, the people who thought it was not a good idea, and I'm not saying you were entirely in that camp, would probably win. I've got to say that at the time when it all happened, and this vote took place wherever it was, in Singapore or wherever it was, and, you know, the great and the good were all there, and we were all leaping up and going down, yes, it's marvellous, we've got the Olympics. And now you think, this is exactly what we don't need. Do we really want to be spending this money? And I've got to say, if it were me, I'd far rather be going to Paris to watch them than Beckton. I mean, that's probably sounds terribly disloyal. But it was a great opportunity to go and see the Olympics live because they would have been close. And now they're here and we're going to have to pay some astronomical amount of money for them.
There's no doubt about it. They're costing a huge amount of money, and it does sound even more huge when we're talking about the debt the country's in and all of that. But the reality is that at the end of it, the East London will be regenerated. Now, you could argue that it should have been regenerated anyway, but if it's taken the Olympics to do that, then that's a benefit. My role, and one of the reasons I took on the role of being the unpaid advisor to the new mayor of London in terms of grassroots sport, was that I was deciding that we wanted to make sure there was that legacy, that, you know, every Londoner by the end of the Olympics or Paralympics would be able to say, well, we've got something out of it in our community. It's not just that six-week wonder. But I think the medals toll and how well we did in Beijing helped to lift the mood a bit. But there's no doubt about it that people don't want to see a huge millions and millions and millions of pounds spent, say, on an opening and closing ceremony like they did in Beijing. And I think what we want is a well-delivered, good-quality games with our athletes doing well, the athletes generally from all the countries enjoying it, and to get away a bit from the sort of whole hype of it being a great multi-million pound raiser of money for the International Olympic Committee.
Yeah, I've got very, as I say, I honestly, I have very mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I suppose it'll be great and we'll all go along. And, you know, and I don't know what, you know, just.
Well, I hope we will all get, because that's a big issue, the ticketing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really important.
For me, I'd love to go along, but I'm really worried about the pricing. I went to the Commonwealth Games when they were in Malaysia, and buying tickets in the UK, they were very, very expensive, but they were very affordable in Malaysia for people who lived in Malaysia, or for people who bought tickets Olympics in Malaysia. And I don't think that, I don't see that happening for a London-based Olympics, that the tickets will be affordable.
I think for some of the events and from some of the earlier rounds of events, they will be determined not to have empty seats, because it's nothing worse than somebody competing in a table tennis tournament with sort of, 40 people watching at the Olympic Games. So there will be a lot of attempts. I know that LOCOG, that's the organising committee chaired by Seb Coe, are making sure that there'll be ways that schools can come in as groups and all that kind of thing. But the tickets for example, the final of the 100 metres is going to be a little bit more difficult to get hold of.
Well, I've got to say I don't really care, because
not a sporty person.
I am. Oh goodness me! Oh, I'm the world's greatest lobber. Do you know about my lobbing? You know about tennis? You know?
Tennis.
Well, I am. Right. You know, I don't even remember. Arantxa Sánchez Vicario. And her moon ball, when she used to hit the ball about 40 million miles in the air. I have actually. I'm of the Arantxa Sánchez Vicario school.
We've heard about it.
I play every Sunday morning. If you want to come to Paddington Rec, you will see a fantastic exhibition of lobbing. I just don't want the riffraff there. We don't want the riffraff coming, spoiling it for celebrities like me. No. The other thing I've got against the Olympics, the thing about Olympics, is there's no table football. It's not a proper, sport. It's the one thing I can do is play table football. It should be an Olympic sport. Now, let me ask you this, Kate. Do you like music?
Yes.
We're a very serious music station here, uh-huh. And I'm going to, if it's okay, we're just going to play a little track now. We're sort of soul, reggae, lovers rock, I believe.
Can I have Bob Marley, Three Little Birds?
If I can find Bob Marley's Three Little Birds, I'll find it for you. But, at the moment, I'm going to give you, we'll come back. We're going to get played Do It to the Music by Raw Silk.
This is Colourful Radio.
Do It to the Music by Raw Silk. Kate Hoey MP was there dancing along to that. She obviously likes that song. And now, we've had an email here from Italy, from RLG, she says, and Italy, oh, he, I don't know why. And this is what he says. He says, the modern Olympics is nothing more than a corrupt, globe-trotting, drug-infested jamboree. The Olympics should return to Greece and be held there every eight years. Soon they'll be moving for the FA Cup to Shanghai, all in the name of widening access to the brand. Well... there's a lot in that, I think, that makes sense to me. I mean, I might be a slightly extreme view, but I think there's a lot in that.
I think there's a lot of people who say that it would be much better to have the Olympics based, once we did it in Greece, to keep it in Greece, to have it as a kind of place that everyone knew was where the Olympics were held. Because, for many, many countries now, it's going to be impossible ever for them to have the Olympic Games. It's only going to be able to go to those countries who either are sort of almost dictators and just make it happen, like China. Or countries, that are very, very well developed. So I think the whole Olympic, the IOC has become, treats itself almost as a government. They think they're more important than governments. And because countries want to keep in with them, they tend to grovel when there's anybody there from the IOC. So I think he's got a lot of right. I just hope that we will try and bring it back a little bit. It's going to be impossible to bring it back to the way the Olympics were.
I don't think we've quite got the confidence to do it, because I think we could. You see, when Boris was, standing there in Boris fashion, I'm trying to unfurl the flag with his jacket open, I thought that was fantastic. I thought, yes, let's do it with a sense of humour. Yeah. You see, the Australians did manage to do it. They had a much, they do have the confidence somehow.
Yeah. I went to Sydney, actually, because I was sports minister then. If you're going to be sports minister for a fairly short time, make sure you're sports minister when they've got the Olympics in Sydney. But it was great. And it was informal, but well done.
Yes.
And I think that's, the British are actually quite good at ceremonial, and I see no reason why we can't do something that's good, but at the same time a bit of normality, and that's where Boris is very good at.
I can see a reason because of the process, you've only got to look at the logo to see what. I mean, let me just tell you about the logo. In a former life, Kate, of course I'm only 35, but in a former life I used to be involved in the advertising world, and we won't go into that, but I did. And I don't think anybody who's been professionally involved with anything, sort of approaching the design, thing would look at that and go, what is that, right? And know perfectly well what it is, which is the result of phenomenal interference. You know, the old thing about, you know, a committee is something that turns a horse into a camel. You know that is what it's about, right? And it's just, you know, people worrying about this and thinking that, you know, that...
But it's also the cost of producing that logo. Look, I could ridiculous.
There's not a designer in London. Mm-hmm. There is not a designer in London who could have not produced something better in 5 minutes flat if they'd been left to get on with it. Mm-hmm. And you know it's politics that have done this. And then, of course, they've all got to defend it. I don't mean politics necessarily with
designed
the big P.
Designed by committee.
Designed by... You know what's happened. Everybody knows. And that's what worries me about the Olympics. We don't have the confidence, you know, for whatever reason, instead of realising that, you know, we can do this with a sense of humour, we can be British about it and, you know, not have to do the ridiculous dragooning of millions of people that the Chinese do so well, and we for some reason are impressed by. So what? So they can get 50 million people to stand up and, you know, hold a card up and simultaneously.
And I think the other thing that maybe this time, because Seb Coe has been an athlete himself, the athletes don't want to have to sit and stand around as they did in Beijing for something like seven hours. Some of them had to wait.
Yeah.
You know, we want a well-presented, simple ceremony that brings the athletes together, which is what it's all about for the opening ceremony, and not all this razzmatazz in an over-indulging way. And I've still got a feeling that we might be able to do that, pull it off a little bit better than...
Let's just move on now to something you're very interested in, which is, I know, you know, sporting facilities for children.
Well, grassroots sport generally.
Yeah, and well...
Not just for young people, but for everybody.
Let me just make an observation here. As I say, in a former life, when I was, you know, I'm actually living two parallel lives. I need to explain this to you, Kate, actually.
I'm getting worried about you.
There's me. I mean, there's a parallel life that's going on. I've lived another life, but I was, you know, in the past. In that life, when I was at school, the facilities were incredible. Everybody did sport. You know, and we're talking, everybody did sport. Then we had this insane selling off the playing fields thing. Now, it's absolutely no question that children simply are not getting out, getting the exercise that they were, you know, how are we going to reverse that position?
Well, I think things are getting better. You're absolutely right. When I was at school too, you automatically played sport on a Wednesday afternoon. You had matches on Saturday mornings. You did all these things. That shows our age. But when...
Toby thinks he's 35.
the curriculum has become much more crowded now. There's an awful lot more where everybody's telling schools what they must do. And therefore, the time is much less. Now, there is a formal government statutory thing that says every child now must have 2 hours of good quality physical education inside the school curriculum and then another 3 hours aspiring to outside the curriculum. In areas like this, of course, in London, there were never playing fields in inner city areas. You always had to be bussed out. So a lot of that hasn't changed. But I think we now have accepted that what went on in terms of playing fields in changing the hours so that teachers didn't have that automatic way that they did, where maths teachers used to take the hockey at my school. You know, the different teachers felt sport was part of the whole way that they became a good teacher. But I do think generally some of the things that are happening now, particularly in primary schools, is changing. The youngsters now are getting more opportunities than they did even 10 years ago, no doubt about it. And one of the things they've brought in is the specialist sports colleges, specialist sports schools that link in with their local secondary schools, link in with their primary schools, and there's a much more of a partnership working. So I'm not as depressed as I was about it, I have to say, 10 years ago, but it's still not what I knew, and I don't think we're still doing our young people the service that they should expect.
We've just been joined by our celebrated newsreader, Chloe. Chloe is perhaps a little younger than even me at 35. Chloe, what was it like at school for you? Do you remember, you know, in terms of school sport, were you a keen athlete?
I was more keen on dance, I think.
You were more keen on dance?
On dance, yeah, but we did have good sporting facilities. You know, we had fields, we could play hockey and netball and rounders. And
oh, my goodness.
Swimming and stuff as well.
Oh, you're far too posh.
Tennis, so. No, I'm not posh.
Oh, my goodness, did you really? Lacrosse?
No, not lacrosse. No, I'm not that posh, Toby.
Brushing your pony. Did you have lessons in brushing your pony?
No, I went to school in London. I'm a London girl.
Are you where? Where did you go to school?
I went to City of London.
Oh, here we go. Yes, yeah. Well, actually, City of London's quite an interesting school because, of course, it's in the middle of the Barbican, yes. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Around there. And where did you do all these sporty things?
We had a playing field kind of out near Grove Park, and also we had kind of fields on the roof and stuff, so we did a lot of
A field on the roof?
Yeah, well, just kind of on the roof. We had sort of, like, playing fields nearby, kind of.
Okay.
But dance, that's... I mean, it's interesting because a lot of young women and girls are really doing a lot of dance now in schools, which wasn't something that was offered when I was at school. So, you know, the opportunities now for other kinds of sport that aren't just straightforward competitive hockey, football, rugby, cricket are much greater. Mm. You know, skateboarding, youngsters love to do. I want youngsters to be doing anything that is keeping them from sitting in front of a computer and using their whatever they call it these days, the latest bit of gimmickry, because that's what you need them out being, enjoying themselves and getting fit and healthy and saving the National Health Service money in the future.
Are you finding that the Olympics is gearing on young people to do more sports? Because that was part of what it said would happen. So are you finding that's happening?
Well, that's what the promise was. And when we got it, we got it on the basis that we were going to inspire young people, or people generally, to participate. No Olympic city has ever got a sustainable increase in participation. I want London to have that, which is why I'm doing the work with the mayor.
Yeah.
OK, back in a second with more from Kate Hoey.
This is Colourful Radio.
We haven't today addressed any of the issues on the programme that have been big in the news, the state of the economy, the budget and what have you. Yesterday, the announcement was that I think the GDP had shrunk by the record amount in the first quarter. Thus, I think in many people's minds, questioning even further Alistair Darling's forecasts about the growth of the economy next year, which he has been apparently very optimistic about. In quotes, and the likelihood, people think, when he comes back in November for the pre-budget report, once again having to revise these things. Now, as an individual member of Parliament, how do you respond to all this? I mean, you're a well-known sort of maverick within Parliament. You clearly have opinions of your own that don't always dovetail with the greater majority of the party or the party line. How do you respond to this? Is this an area where you particularly have any interest? Is there anything you can say?
Well, I think we all have to have an interest because it's affecting all our livelihoods and all my constituents and the people who are already been made unemployed and the small businesses that aren't getting loans when they're expecting them, and all of that is affecting everybody. I come from the era and was brought up in an era where if you didn't have the money, you didn't spend it. But of course, that changed as gradually more and more people were able to borrow and get mortgages and that kind of thing, and we grew to. But what I find still, I do not understand how, if you are in a terrible, terrible state, how the answer seems to be to tell people to spend even more, borrow even more, and go into even greater debt. And I do think that if there wasn't a general election on the horizon, probably the attempts to actually reduce the debt, because in the long term it's not going to be us two, it might be you because you're slightly younger too.
I don't know who she's looking at. She's obviously looking at me.
Paying this off, I think that we are in a real mess, and I think there is the public deserve politicians to be honest, and I think that's the real danger of what was said by Alistair Darling this week, and the real danger of the way the government has been presenting this, almost that we're not as bad as people out there think we are, and we are.
It seems to me we're in a kind of political stasis at the moment because and we all know the election is going to be next year. The government don't want to move. It's all post 2011. The Conservatives don't want to commit themselves because they don't want to, they don't want to be, seen to be climbed all over by the government, give away their policies. The Liberal Party, quite honestly, we all know Lib Dems are not going to get elected, so they're the ones people who can commit. And actually, if I think their policy of actually saying concrete things is a very good one, because it probably will win them some votes come the next election, but. We won't really need is an election now, do we not? So we can actually then sort it out and move forward.
I think there is this is going to be a very difficult year because there's so much uncertainty, and you're absolutely right. that people are looking ahead to the polls. I think the average person in this country, if you were to ask them how they would save some money in government, would come up with all sorts of ideas. I mean, I could save millions tomorrow by announcing we will not go ahead with the ridiculous identity cards.
But why are they going ahead? Nobody wants them.
I think in the end they will drop it. But by the time they get round to changing their policies, which they do eventually, having ignored everybody who's asked for them to change it, then the money, a lot of them, that money has been committed. There's always within the civil service and within government departments people who have been wanting things to happen for years. I remember when I was in the Home Office, ID cards was around. Jack Straw at that time as Home Secretary just wouldn't let it surface. But eventually, because of the terrorism threats, then that was the opportunity to use to get some Home Office official came up, government goes along with it, and suddenly we're landed with this hugely expensive nonsense that is just going to do nothing to make us feel safer.
But again, I look at it and go, yeah, but why? If we all, I mean, let's be honest about it. Anybody who's committed enough to be a terrorist, you know, and has got the infrastructure to arrange some ghastly, incident or whatever, however you want to call it, has probably got the wherewithal to work out how to beat the identity card system.
Exactly.
It just doesn't make sense to me. And I look at these things, why? Who is making these decisions? And that is the bit, I suppose. I don't know whether it's a government that's tired, whether it's had its day, whether it's just exhausted by endlessly having to fight fires everywhere. I mean, that must come into it, mustn't it, at some point?
I think there is a kind of trend in this country where after a certain period of time, governments start to make mistakes, and then those mistakes almost become, after the G20, everyone thought, oh, that'll be, you know, that's a little bit better now for Gordon Brown. And then, of course, we got that ridiculous smearing leaks stuff.
Which, Do you think he knew? Did he know? Do you think Gordon Brown knew?
He obviously knew Damien McBride very well, because he was his... His real.
Well, I mean, last night on Have I Got for News for You, Ian Hislop said about as explicitly as you could. In fact, I think he did say explicitly at one point, but he slightly revised it. Of course, Ian Hislop is also the editor of Private Eye, that Gordon Brown must have known what he was doing.
Well, Gordon Brown did have lunch with Derek Draper not long after they'd set up the website. I just found that almost the most dreadful thing that has happened recently in terms of the image generally of politics and politicians. And that's what worries me more than anything else. You know, I grew up to respect MPs, to think that politics in this country was, you know, we had a democracy that was really, really worth fighting for, worth defending. And more, you know, when you see the public being so cynical about us all, and it does make you despair. And the longer term, you know, I want young people to still think that democracy works. And at the moment, it's not looking a very, very, let's say very credible.
Hey, I don't think you need to worry too much in terms of hate of politicians, because you're still on the estate agents and bankers at this current time.
Yes. Well, I suppose that's something.
Yeah, well.
But I would say, just in defence of MPs, I mean, most members of parliament go into politics because they really do, whatever party they're in, they want to try and make things better. Some go about it differently than others, and some are...
Isn't some of it ego?
Yeah.
Well, some of everything's ego, apart from me, of course. I have no ego at all. I'd never be doing... I don't think that matters. I think what matters is that, first of all, I totally agree with you. In fact, generally speaking, I think most people do things for what they believe to be the right reason rather than the wrong one. There are cases, going back to the expenses this year, I don't want to rehash that all that again, where...
We don't get second homes.
No.
Inner London MPs don't get any of that.
No,
I don't get any of that.
Well, I mean, there is a system in place. People have obviously been believed that it was something that they could do without seeming to me to ask the obvious question, should we be doing it, whether we can,
Within
morally right? And they go right to the top of government. I saw Tony McNulty back on the television the other day, and I just cannot believe they're fielding him again. The Minister of London, he's off the screen for a couple of weeks after the story about his parents' house in Harrow. Yeah. A lot of it I don't get. But again, it's on both sides, because last night Alan Duncan was on, and one who is the shadow leader of the House, I think, and Ian Hislop pointed out, he was asking how many houses he had and what he was doing them. I think a lot of people have been taking advantage of this.
I think it all stemmed from the fact that at one time, a long time ago, MPs worked very late hours and they weren't very well paid. And so part of the thing was this allowances, expenses, but it actually became, instead of an expense that you claimed with a receipt, it became an automatic allowance that you were given. And so they didn't even have to, you know, give any detail. Now that has changed. We're paid, I think, adequately. And we shouldn't be getting all those extras, or those MPs who have genuine expenses should have to show receipts, and that's it. But the idea that you come and clock on, Gordon Brown's brilliant, you know, 2 minute back of a.
But what's going to happen next week on the vote? Is going to be a three line party whip?
I'm not sure. The MPs on this will not be whipped. But I do think it may end up that we don't get a vote on that particular bit. I think some of the other things he's suggesting may go through. It was all too quickly convenient in order to try and detract from the budget. I think that's why Gordon Brown announced it on YouTube. He should have announced it on Colourful Radio.
He should. But, you know, the YouTube broadcast of him is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Somebody should just say, Gordon, don't do it. Stop trying to smile.
Oh, there's a smile.
It just can't do it. He's got this sort of rictus smile that he sort of comes in at places. And I, you know, I've heard people that, you know, I've known. So actually, he's a very nice guy.
He says very nice things about you.
He does, I know. But he's not good on that.
No.
Okay. I know you have a keen interest in Zimbabwe, and you were telling me some extraordinary things off mic just now about going undercover to Zimbabwe. So will you tell us what you've been doing?
Yes, about 6 years ago I first went over to Zimbabwe. Obviously, as a British MP, they wouldn't let you in formally. They weren't letting the media in, and they weren't letting... So I went to see for myself with another person what was happening, and we happened to be there at the time when they were doing the Operation Drive Out Rubbish, which was when they went to all the little settlements around the main suburban areas and literally knocked people's homes down and kicked them out. We saw it in both happening in Harare and down in Bulawayo. And I was able to bring some film out of what was happening, taken by me, which wasn't brilliant film, but which Newsnight used and which we got a lot of coverage. And then I think that gave me the impetus really to make sure that our government was doing what it could to keep the pressure on. I also went to meet some of the displaced farm workers. You know, there was a lot of talk about white farmers losing their farms, but the people who suffered terribly were the workers on those farms who were just dumped literally by the war veterans who'd gone in and taken over the farms, dumped them, wouldn't allow them to get access. So-called war veterans, yeah, very young war veterans, hadn't seen much war. And it was really, really dreadful. And the people that I met who kept saying to me, you know, please, please get somebody to do something about this. This can't go on. And then I went back a second time just after the trade unionists had been beaten up. In the meantime, I was obviously keeping in touch with the opposition there and what was going on. And it was the third time that I was in that I got, I nearly got caught. But I got out. Getting out's always the worst bit because you have to sort of, you know, that's the bit where you just know that if they see you as you're going through. And afterwards, the Minister for the Interior there, Didius Matasa, a pretty nasty person, I have to say, wrote this big piece in the Harare papers about me, exposing me and saying that if ever I came back to Zimbabwe, I would be humiliated and put in prison for life. So my test of whether the Zimbabwe country has changed will be when I can fly in legally to Harare and not be arrested and humiliated.
Well, I've got to say, I think that's extremely brave of you because... you know, these people aren't to be messed about with, you know, and...
Afterwards, I always felt, at the time, your adrenaline's there and you just feel you're doing the right thing. But when you think about it in the cold, clear light, probably it was a bit risky. Never mind.
We were just discussing off air a marvellous book about Zimbabwe called Tears of a Crocodile. I just cannot remember the name of the author. It's Peter somebody. But it's an absolutely brilliant book. And if anybody out there wants to know anything about Zimbabwe, go and read it. It's quite brilliant.
This is Colourful Radio.